Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED. From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Grace Wan, in for Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, our cultural obsession with posture. For much of the 20th century, Americans were told that they were living through a poor posture epidemic that, if left unchecked, would lead to widespread illness, disability, and even death. That's according to UPenn historian Beth Linker, whose new book, Slouch, looks at how religion, pseudoscience, and ableism created a public health panic about posture, along with a minor industry of clothing, shoes, and medical devices to eradicate the slouch. We talked to Linker about how that history impacts us today. Join us. Welcome to Forum. I'm Grace Wan, in for Mina Kim. If you're sitting down as you listen to this show or you're taking a walk, this show might have you throwing back your shoulders, standing a little straighter, and lifting up your head. That's because we're talking about the cultural history of posture. There was a time in this country when posture was equated not just with health, but also good character, the ability to hold a job, or even intelligence. Doctors, teachers, political figures worried that poor posture signaled moral decline and treated slumped shoulders and rounded backs like they were part of an epidemic. It's a fascinating and forgotten social history that UPenn history and social science professor Beth Linker recounts in her new book, Slouch, Posture Panic in Modern America. Welcome to Forum, Professor Linker.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure being here.
Well, your book uncovers this forgotten period of time that is so fascinating. And it begins with a scandal that erupted in 1995 when the New York Times reported that the Smithsonian had decades worth of nude photos of college students, which was a common practice to take these pictures at schools like Yale, Harvard, Ivy League schools, and women colleges like Wellesley and Smith, and many other colleges around the country. Why were there these pictures of co-eds, who included like George W. Bush, Hillary Clinton, Meryl Streep? What were the purpose of these photos?
That's a good question. This is kind of the expose that started me off on this book. Those photos were at the Smithsonian. They were held at the William Sheldon Papers. William Sheldon used posture photos. He wasn't really a posture scientist, though. But in any case, why did those photos exist? So he used these posture photos, and how could he find these pieces of data so readily? And that he was able to find them because since about in the 19 teens, most universities started adopting a regimen whereby every admitted student would undergo a posture evaluation. And slowly over time, it became the gold standard for it to be a posture photograph. And the phys ed department of these universities and colleges would use these photographs to then designate each student with a grade and then track them into a particular phys ed class so that out of this we get remedial phys ed classes and phys ed classes that are for, quote unquote, the more advanced person.
And they were tracking what exactly? The way people were standing?
Yeah, it's a good question. Mostly standing. All right. So standing posture was the norm, and they would measure plumb line verticality. So that is still used today. If you go into a physical therapy clinic, they will have a plumb line. It is often referred to by artists as well. And that is in, so from a side view, right, is the head above the shoulders or the shoulders above the hips or the hips above the knees or the knees above the feet. And so that was the way that they decided to measure. That was the easiest way to measure human posture.
It's, you know, I have to admit, I read the book and I was talking to my mother-in-law, who is a proud graduate of Smith College, class of 1956. Mm. And I said, did you ever have one of these pictures taken? And she said, oh, my goodness, yes. And we lived in, it was, first of all, mortifying. And we lived in fear that these photographs would be stolen and that all the men at Yale had pictures of us nude and were evaluating us. So this practice started in the teens, but went well into the 50s because of this posture panic.
Yes. So it was particularly important for women educators to do this in the early 20th century because there were a lot of male faculty at the most elite places arguing that women shouldn't be in school, that it was bad for their reproductive health. And, you know, they had great concerns that if women went on to university and college, and we're talking mainly white women here, if those women went off to university and college, that would delay their reproductive years. But they pathologized it. They really thought that all the energy, and meaning like physiological energy, needed to go to the womb and not to the brain. And so women's colleges started to keep track quite religiously of anthropometric data. So this is any kind of physical data that they could get on the women co-eds. And they were called co-eds because the normal student was a male student. So the women were called co-eds. So they would measure the female students, and they would have report after report trying to demonstrate that women actually got healthier when in college or at the university. And so in some ways, the early posture photos and exams could be seen in a female space as a feminist movement. There's one woman who I talk about, Dr. Clelia Mosher. She was out in Stanford. She developed a device called the schematograph. And this was more of like, well, I don't know if your listeners will understand this, like overhead projectors.
Yeah.
You know, it was more like a tracing, a camera obscura. And Clelia wanted this to become a standard practice of measuring female students. And she taught women posture exercises because she believed it helped with menstruation. She believed it helped with menstrual pain. And she also did all of these really interesting studies demonstrating that men and women have equal physiological capacities. And the posture standard was one of those. And in a time when, if anybody's done the president's fitness test, and you know, there are different measures for male, female, Clelia developed this posture standard that was the same for men and women.
I think I'm still scarred by that presidential fitness test. I mean, I think I did do like just a hanging.
We all are.
I mean, I could barely do a chin-up. I wanted to, you mentioned that this national obsession with posture obviously predated these photographs. And where did this posture panic emanate from originally? How did the nation become gripped by this?
So posture has been a concern since, you know, the ancient Greeks. It wasn't that suddenly everybody noticed human posture as something that was noteworthy. And then by the Enlightenment period, you get a lot of etiquette manuals. Posture is very important for social class. What's interesting is that in most of those etiquette manuals, if you are the upper class, upper crust, you're supposed to have a kind of languid slouch about you. To sit bolt upright would be a characteristic of a lower class person. But then this changes when Darwin publishes On the Origin of Species in 1859. In that book, Darwin posits that the first human being came from a simian, right? And the first step in evolution was upright standing. This was rather radical because evolutionary theories before Darwin mostly thought of, so say Lamarck, Lamarckians, and folks like that, thought that the first thing that had to evolve or made humans different from simians was brain capacity, intelligence. And that's where you get all the skull hunters going around the world looking for skulls and phrenology, because the belief was that the most important attribute that distinguishes human beings from simians is brain capacity and intelligence. So Darwin's theory, by contrast, says, actually, you know what's the most important? Standing up straight. And so after Darwin wrote this, there were a lot of anthropologists, paleoanthropologists, who also happened to be physicians, who wanted to prove that this theory was correct. And I tell the story of the first such person, Eugene Du Bois, who discovered a femur and a skull on the island of Java, and he designated that Pithecanthropus erectus, which then became redesignated to what we all know as Homo erectus. And so this set off, so what I try to establish in my book, you know, writing from the 21st century, I know that posture is still important for social cues and etiquette, but I was seeing something else. I was seeing this scientization and medicalization of posture that I argue is unique to the modern period.
It definitely seems to take over in the late 19th century, early 20th century, because it's not, even though it's not a medical problem per se, it begins to be treated as one.
That's correct. And what I show in the book is that it's what medical, so you get a whole bunch of, you get medical physicians, you get physical therapists, you get physical educators, all coming together in the progressive era. And they see that posture is, it's easy to assess, right? That's pretty easy to assess somebody's posture if they're standing next to a wall or a plumb line, or you take a posture photograph or a tracing paper. It's not that difficult. And what they like about this assessment is that it's holistic. Mm. They can look at the whole body in one glance. And they start to develop these theories that poor posture leads to bad health.
Well, we're talking with Beth Linker. She's the author of her new book, Slouch, Posture Panic in Modern America. She's a professor of history and social sciences at the University of Pennsylvania. And we'd love to hear from you. What were you taught about good and bad posture growing up? Email your comments or questions to forum@kqed.org or call us at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. I'm Grace Wan, in for Mina Kim. More about posture after the break.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Grace Wan, in for Mina Kim. We're talking about the cultural history behind posture, where the idea of good posture comes from, how a fear of bad posture gripped the nation throughout the 20th century, and what the impacts of the posture panic movement are today. We're joined by Beth Linker, author of Slouch, Posture Panic in Modern America. Linker is a professor of history and social sciences at the University of Pennsylvania. And we'd love to hear from you. What were you taught about good and bad posture growing up, and What does bad posture look like to you, and what traits do you associate with good or bad posture? You can email your comments and questions to forum@kqed.org, find us on social channels at KQED Forum, or give us a call now at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Before the break, we were talking about some of the people who had influenced the posture movement in the United States. And one of the people you mentioned is Jesse Bancroft, who was the self-proclaimed founder of the American Posture League. What did Jesse do with the American Posture League to influence how the nation kind of perceived posture as a problem?
Yes. So Jesse was quite an empire builder. she was director of physical education in New York City public schools. And her first order of business, she was trained and she got her training mostly by self-learning, but she did work with Sargent up in Harvard. So her first order of business was to bring posture exercises and posture training into the classroom. So Jesse Bancroft would use things like wooden window poles, and she would put them up against, you know, a student and see if the student could like stand up straight. So that was her way of measuring posture. She had students get on their desks and do what we would think of as crunches or sit-ups on their desk. So this was an era before there were designated gymnasiums in most schools. And Jesse Bancroft was interested in getting these youngsters to stand up straight because she believed that it was necessary to ward off childhood diseases, that it was necessary to take in fresh air properly, that it was necessary to digest food properly. And then also there was the cultural component. As physical education director of New York City schools in the early 20th century, a lot of immigrants were coming to the city. And so it was also a way to Americanize a whole host of immigrant children. And the hope was that these children would go home to their mom and dad and, you know, say, hey, look, I learned this posture exercise and I learned how important posture is at school. And did you know that if you have bad posture, you can end up with tuberculosis. Yeah. You can end up with all of these bad diseases if you don't have proper posture.
And what was the science behind that in equating bad posture with the possibility of getting this communicable disease, TB?
Well, if you think about it, you know, in the 1880s, the tubercle bacillus was first discovered. Up until then, it was thought to be a hereditary disease. From the 1880s until the 19-teens, there's a mixture of health beliefs. Some people might believe in the germ theory of disease. Other people might not. And then we also have to consider that this is an era before antibiotics. So while scientists knew that tuberculosis was a contagious disease, they didn't have a really foolproof cure. They didn't have a magic bullet. People went off to sanatoriums, you know, took bed rest, that kind of thing. So it's what happens in the early 20th century is that you get people more interested in preventative health then. How can we prevent things like tuberculosis from happening? It was called the seed and soil debate. So the seed is the bacteria or the virus, but the soil is the body. So I think we can all relate to this today, right? Like, why do some people get COVID and others don't? Why do some people have long COVID and others don't? And in that space, a lot of health beliefs proliferate without solid evidence of with one kind of health belief being more scientific than the other. So that's what was happening at this time. The other thing to keep in mind in this context was eugenics. The eugenics movement was in full bloom at this point. And the posture advocates and crusaders, as I call them, were more on the side of soft eugenics. So hard eugenics scholars usually attribute movements in sterilization, forced sterilization of non-white populations, because the argument was you don't want ill-fit people to reproduce and affect the future generations. Posture crusaders were more on the soft eugenics side, a little bit more, if we can get everybody to stand up straight, that will help future generations. But they were not necessarily advocates of hard eugenics.
Hmm. Well, we're talking about the cultural history behind posture with Beth Linker, who's the author of Slouch, Posture Panic in Modern America. And we're hearing from you about your views about posture, what you were taught growing up. And were you tested for posture in your school or college? And what types of exercises or ergonomic setups do you engage in to help with your posture? You can email your comments and questions to forum at kqed.org. Find us on our social channels at KQED Forum, or give us a call now at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. One listener tweets, at a private girls' school in San Francisco in the 50s and 60s, our posture was corrected at the lunch table with a firm tap on the back with a wooden ruler. So, seems familiar. Let's go to Tim and Arinda. Tim, welcome to Forum.
Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate this topic. I was always taller than normal growing up as a young man, about 6'4 plus during, you know, kind of my maturation. And my mother was over 6 feet herself. And one of the primary pieces of advice that she gave me was that tall people especially needed to have very good posture, maybe because it was obvious when, you know, you stood out anyway, but but she just felt that it looked, you know, very poorly, right, on that individual. Anyhow, so, you know, she carried herself very strongly through life and, you know, kind of, and very prominently. And I copied her style, and it, I can't tell you how many comments, positive comments I got as a young man, you know, oh, you have such good posture, that kind of thing.
Well,
and, anyhow.
Yeah, Tim, how's your posture today?
Actually, it has stayed with me all my life. I'm just about 70, and I continue to be, you know, kind of almost as if I had been, you know, kind of in the military or something, I suppose.
Well, Beth, I think that's so fascinating. Here's Tim, who is 70 years old and got that message from his mother that good posture is noticeable. It has positive attributes. So this posture panic has stayed with us even today.
Yes, I think there is a really entrenched stigma to poor posture. And I think also today more of the belief is if I don't keep good posture, I will then end up with back pain. And the science on that, current science, is really not upholding that health belief. It's questioning that health belief. And I think it makes sense why it is questioning that health belief, because first of all, what is good posture for whom? You know, we're so anatomically different and individual. And it's not clear for how long would I need to slouch in order to increase my chances to get back pain. But it also has, it carries this. So it's when it becomes medicalized that I think the stigma of poor posture and slouching becomes even more amplified.
Yeah, because there's with poor posture, I mean, even today, there's the connotation of, you know, you're not holding yourself well, perhaps you're a little lazy, you're not paying attention, you look a little slouchy. I mean, those are not good things. I mean, I read your book and every 5 minutes I kept like sitting up straight. It was very
stealth.
It's stealth.
It's a stealth public health message.
But it's fat. I mean, I will say also, having read the book, the next day, Instagram was sending me so many ads for orthopedic shoes.
Welcome to my world.
Yes, I'm sure. I got a corset recommendation. I thought to myself, it's not that bad.
I mean, yes. Yes, I keep getting the Taylor Swift feeds of because Taylor Swift wore a sports bra that this new company is saying is a posture corrector bra. Well, so I keep getting those ads.
Well, a lot of these is sorts of corrective medical devices and whatnot came out of this period. I mean, I was fascinated that Dr. Scholl's and Buster Brown's, these are types of orthopedic shoes, emanate from this period. I wonder what Jesse Bancroft, the American Posture League founder, would think about Hoka's and Birkenstocks.
I think she'd be all in. I think she'd be on the ad endorsing them. What's interesting about the posture panic is, you know, the medicalization makes it even more dire to slouch. And then all of these industries see a market. You got an advertisement for corsetry, which is kind of bizarre if you think about it, since in the turn of the 20th century, it looked like the corsetry industry was going to just cease to exist. They were really struggling. And then they get wind of this like new science in this posture crusade movement, and they think, aha, that's what we do. We make posture correcting corsets. And so they kind of wrap their new corsetry in the language of science, and they move more to separates, so girdles and belts, and then those get publicized or advertised to men and women equally. So you have men wearing pretty much corsets. They won't say they're wearing corsets, but they are wearing corsets. JFK wore a kind of corset, a back brace. So it's genius. It's like wonderful for the industries, the shoe industry, the corsetry industry, and other industries that touch on posture.
Well, even the sports jacket comes out of the posture movement. Isn't that right?
Yes. 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 So the sports jacket, sports shoes. So, you know, your kids' shoes, Buster Brown, as you mentioned, which today are Naturalizer and Vionic. These industries really used the posture panic, the posture epidemic language in order to bring people in to buy their wares. And what is interesting, you know, we all think about orthopedic shoes and, you know, I'm a woman in my early 50s. And of course, I'm looking for the shoe that like feels good, but is fashionable. It's exactly what they were trying to do in the interwar years, in the 30s and 40s. It didn't really take off for women immediately because women, it was still considered de classe to not wear something of a heel. So women, though, started in this era because of the posture panic. They started to buy different kinds of shoes, right, for different venues. So they would have maybe a sporting shoe, and then they would have their Sunday shoe. So it's fascinating to look at these consumer goods and how this panic gets written into the consumer goods.
There's always capitalism. You cannot avoid it. Let's go back to the phone. Suzanne from San Carlos, welcome to Forum.
Thank you. I went to an all-girls school in the 1960s, and there was a required class for us from grade 7 to 12 based on the teachings of a woman named Bess Menzendeek. It was taught entirely professionally, but we were required to attend, I think it was once a week, although in my horror of it, it may have been twice a week, and all we could wear was our underpants. And yes. As I say, and there were mirrors in the front of us and mirrors in the back of us. And our teacher, as I say, was totally professional. We learned about art latissimus, and that's the only one I remember. But, you know, she referred to all our muscle groups. She taught us exercises that, of course, we were supposed to do at home, and none of us did. But, you know, the emphasis was on straight posture and on the alignment of our muscles and our bones, the emphasis being on good carriage for our health. And, you know, we thought it was so weird. My father was a surgeon. He was eventually on the board of trustees. And I said, oh, Dad, come on, can't you get this out of the curriculum? And he did an investigation, and he came back with the conclusion that there was nothing wrong with it, you know, no harm. And so it stayed. I don't know how long it stayed at my school, but it certainly was part of this whole posture thing.
Suzanne, were you taught to walk with books on your head?
No.
Oh, okay. That wasn't in there. I mean, you could be in this book, Suzanne. I mean,
yes, Suzanne, you could be in this book.
Beth, I mean, the prevalence of these posture classes, you know, going well into the 60s, and the fact that people didn't think there was anything wrong with it. I mean, is there anything wrong with wanting people to stand up straight?
Can I speak to the Bess Messendig, the caller, and then I will answer that question. Thank you, caller, for bringing up that story. Bess was actually colleagues with Hans Krauss, who was the posture guru and personal posture physician for John F. Kennedy. Yeah. And Bess also worked at Yale. So you can find back issues of Life magazine that feature her. It was a bit controversial because she did teach students in the nude. She insisted that students be in the nude and that there were mirrors. So is there anything wrong with that? Well, I think, you know, I think what it is it doesn't permit a certain kinds of bodies to be in that class. For most of the book, when I'm talking about posture right or posture perfection classes, and I'm talking about universities and schools, anybody who has a significant disability is not in those spaces. And so it has this ableist feeling to it, to be paying that close of attention to posture. And I think all of the economic resources and the money, if it goes into perfecting posture of the already top 1%, what about the people who actually have, say, back pain, and can they get the treatment that they need? So so I don't think it's wrong necessarily. I'm not a posture denier. If you want to go pay attention to your posture, by all means, go for it. But I think it's about resources. Like, where do we put our concerns and our resources? And unfortunately, the posture epidemic made it so that individuals were to blame. You know, if you have back pain, that means you weren't doing something right. Instead of looking at larger socioeconomic issues, such as, do you have housing?
Right.
Do you have a good education? Do you have food? And so instead of, you know, a whole class on posture, I think I'd just prefer a class talking about health more generally, holistically.
Well, we're talking about posture and the cultural history behind it. I'm Grace Wan, in for Mina Kim. More Forum after this break.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Grace Wan, in for Mina Kim. We're all sitting up a little straighter here in the studio because we're talking about posture with Beth Linker. She's the author of Slouch, Posture Panic in Modern America. Linker is a professor of history and social sciences at the University of Pennsylvania. And we're hearing from you listeners about your relationship with posture, both good and bad. Davon writes, when I was little, we used to do a posture exercise from romper room. We'd practice all the time with a basket on our head. And Carol writes, when I entered Barnard in 1954, the college doctor assessed posture and pronation, which meant flat feet. She also administered a Rorschach test to determine whether we were, quote, normal for our age. I knew I had flat feet, but my posture passed muster despite my mother's lament that I didn't stand straight. I mean, listeners, people have had experiences with posture. It's not easy. Before the break, we were talking about whether posture, worrying about it, is a good or a bad thing. And one other aspect of your book that I found really fascinating was the racialization of posture. You know, just starting with Darwin, on the one hand, there's this valorization of like, oh, the way that, quote unquote, primitive people stand and walk in nature is something to be admired. And yet, you know, within the country and the continent, people of different races were sort of looked down upon because of their posture. Can you talk a little bit about how, quote, this idea of humans in their natural form sort of inflected this posture movement?
Yes, there's a paradox in the thinking among scientists that does start with Darwin and thereafter. So the concern of posture crusaders, and I would say from the late 19th century, and arguably even to certain scientists today, they blame civilization for bad posture. So the thinking goes like this. So the first attribute to make us fully human was upright standing. But then we look around and we see a bunch of people slouching, complaining of back pain, complaining of other illnesses or discomfort. And so physicians start to think that it's quote unquote civilization that is causing the problem. And in the early 20th century, you'll have writers talking about over civilization, which what they meant by that was shorthand for too much leisure. You know, with the advent of trains and cars, people didn't have to walk or work that hard to get places. So there was just a more like sedentary life. And this was a real concern for them. And so they started to look at quote unquote uncivilized people and saw, so in this country, they really valorized the Native American. So they would valorize indigenous peoples. And there was a posture pin that the American Posture League made and forged, and they would give that out to somebody who had perfect posture. And in the pin, on the pin, was the likeness of a Lenape Native American warrior. And so it became coded as that's good posture. Now, just because they lauded this kind of imagined ideal of the Native American having good posture, just because they did that didn't mean that they gave indigenous peoples rights. They could still kind of simultaneously hold this view that these were unintelligent, backward people, and also we can kind of appropriate something in their culture, namely their upright posture, and make that our own. And in the Black community, it's really interesting. So middle-class Black intellectuals and scientists and physicians in the early 20th century start what would be the beginnings of a Black pride movement. They go to places like Haiti, and they look at the Zulu women in South Africa, and they say, these are our people, and look at how beautiful and graceful these women walk around with their head carrying. And then those Black middle-class writers castigate the lower-class Black people and worry that those lower-class Black individuals are going to bring them down if they don't adopt a good posture.
So it has a lot of racial overtones that even continue to today. So anytime today we have scientists saying, you know what we need to do? We need to adopt paleo posture. You know, they go out and they look for quote unquote hunter-gatherer groups in Africa and in Asia and Latin America. And they study them and they insist, the scientists insist that these people don't suffer back pain, and then also assess their posture and say, look, these people stand upright. They don't travel in cars or trains or planes. They walk, they're physically active, and therefore they have paleo posture. And then they bring that back to westernized culture for the middle class, upper class fitness people. And then they sell that as an idea when it's pretty dubious, I think.
A lot of appropriation going on. A listener writes, I grew up in the late 60s and early 70s. My father was Marine when he was in his early 20s. He would bellow at me, C-O-B-I, when he saw me slouching in my preteen years. It meant chest out, butt in. So, I'm not surprised that a military person would want good posture. Let's go back to the phones. Susie in Sacramento, welcome to Forum.
Thank you. I'm very interested in this because I was raised, I'm 80, so I was raised in the 40s and 50s, and my mother was absolutely set on us having good posture. We would occasionally, as we were younger, walk down the hallway with books on our head so that she could check our posture. And she, till we were grown, I think even after, she would say, sit up straight. So I'm very well aware of it. I've never had a back pain. I'm very overweight. I'll tell you what's really bothering me today. I think that the young people of today have no idea what posture is. And mainly, I'm not talking about the kids that are very astute. I'm talking about mainstream America. And I think a lot of it has to do with we think we're in a comfort zone. The less we have to do, the better. I'll tell you when it really affects me personally is when I go into a furniture store and I cannot find a comfortable living room chair that sits straight up. The back is always tilted now. And I don't know how you feel about posture, but I feel that it's very concerning. And I have a very difficult time finding any comfortable chair that doesn't have the back tilted just a bit back.
Well, I think that that is a difficulty and that, again, ergonomics comes out of this posture panic in terms of finding the right kinds of chairs to sit in. But I wanted to ask you, I mean, Beth, you're in a former life, you're a physical therapist, and you obviously have spent a lot of time thinking about posture. I mean, the medicalization of posture, as you say in your book, is, you know, can go too far. But, I mean, we're getting a lot of listeners asking, do you think that posture is just not important at all to health? Or do you not see the physical benefits of good posture?
Sure, yeah. So I think what I'm arguing is that I don't know if the science doesn't necessarily to this date support that it's very predictive of future health. So that's pretty much the only thing that, you know, I'm taking issue with. I don't think we have enough studies, scientific studies out there to tell us exactly, because I think it's very difficult to study. So I will admit I do yoga. I have my ergonomic chair. I have a standing desk. But in my mind, when I'm doing those things, it's about motion, right? It's not about keeping some sort of like upright posture. It's about changing your position a lot. And for me, that's what's important. So sometimes I do want the ergonomic chair with like the lumbar support, depending on how I'm feeling. But maybe you don't want that to be too comfy, because if you're there for 2 to 3 hours, that's not good, right? And so it's a balancing act. I just don't think that it's about I don't do these activities to keep my posture upright.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you're just, it's almost strength more than anything. You know, so this posture panic that takes us through the 20th century, it ultimately subsides and maybe subsumes into other things. How does a posture panic sort of resolve itself?
I don't know that it does. Mm-hmm. I think the thing for me is that I think I was surprised at how little real scientific research there is on it. I think it was taken as scientific truth at a time when the standards of what counted as scientific evidence were not as rigorous. And then when there was the few people who tried to study it, so to study it properly would be to do it in a longitudinal way. And these posture photos would be the perfect data set, right? So, you know, some of your listeners are calling in and saying, I remember having my posture photo. So a scientist could go in and say, I'm going to go look at your early posture photo. And now I'm going to interview you 20, 30, 40 years later and look at your health history. And if you were flagged early on as having bad posture, are you more likely to have more pain or not? There was somebody who tried to do that study at Smith College in the late 1970s and early 80s. And she got stymied along the way because a lot of people were upset about the fact that the posture photos still existed and that the university wasn't necessarily taking good care of them, of the photos. She did end up completing her study, not the full vision that she had of it. She did end up completing the study, and it showed that there wasn't really much difference in prevalence of back pain in a longitudinal study between those who had, quote unquote, bad posture in their posture photo and those who had good posture, that the chance of getting back pain was pretty much equivalent. And so I think that kind of study is pretty powerful. And there are more studies today by physical therapists that are confirming that. So it's more about changing our ideas about what we think good posture does for us.
Right. Well, you're listening to Forum. I'm Grace Wan, in for Mina Kim. I wanted to talk a little bit more about when we talk about good posture, who it leaves out. You mentioned, you know, earlier about if you don't have great posture or if you have a back issue or, you know, a spinal issue or a disability. I mean, good posture and the idea of it almost promotes a form of ableism. Tell us a little bit about that and how it still stays with us.
Yes, I kind of always think of the public health adage that we hear all the time now, sitting is the new smoking. And every time I hear that, I think, what about the people in wheelchair users? You know, mm-hmm. What does that say? You know, what kind of message is that? It's a very ableist message. It automatically discounts the people who live their lives quite healthfully in as a wheelchair users. And so I think this kind of fixation on posture perfection is exactly that. It's a perfection, body perfection project. And it does not take account of the myriad anatomies and diversity of individuals that we see. So it's very hard to come up with a standard. It's very hard to come up with a norm. And to insist on a standard or norm, like this plumb line verticality, immediately marginalizes anyone who can't, for no fault of their own, meet that standard. So it has a way of really being unnecessarily, in my mind, stigmatizing. And so in my story there, you know, people with disabilities could not gain access to places of higher education until the disability rights movement. And as I write in my book, one of the things that brought the end to the posture photography and posture assessments in college campuses was that you had people with moderate to severe disabilities making a very big, you know, making their way into the college campuses through legal action, through activism, because if, you know, a lot of these people were post-polio wheelchair users. And so it's been a long, hard fight that isn't even complete about making universities accessible. Universities are some of the most inaccessible places still to this day.
A listener writes, I've noticed that young women today have much better posture than I did when I grew up in the 1950s and 70s. I'm convinced it's because they feel empowered and seen. So there's a, you know, a hope for that. In the minute we have left, Beth, I wanted to talk about how a through line of your work is that civilization is almost corrupting to health. And, you know, on the one hand, it's civilizing. It brings us lots of benefits. But on the other hand, it makes us lazy and, you know, and technology being the worst of all. I mean, what are you looking out for next as you think about where this idea of civilization as the problem might take us? I mean, what will be our next epidemic, that next health crisis that we view as an epidemic?
Well, I think, you know, tech neck is out there already as the next epidemic. Everybody craning their necks down to look at their phones. I think we will always find, if there's anything that this book has taught me, is that with every new technology, there is this panic and fear that it somehow is going to make us devolve or very unhealthy or not be able to live in the world. And it's interesting to see that steady progress. First it was the radio, then it was the TV, and then it was the computer, and then now it's phones. And every step you can just see this kind of very similar rhetoric, and somehow we all survive
right,
and go on to live our lives. And I don't know if we're really having much more back pain than we were in the 1950s. You know, I don't think there's enough evidence to suggest that either.
Well, I'm sure that you and I will be standing at our standing desks with a treadmill underneath our feet. And I don't know, maybe I will get that corset. I mean, it did make me feel bad about my slouching. And will you do the same in your office at UPenn?
I will. I will not go the corset route, but I will be using my ergonomic chair and my standing desk.
Yes. And hopefully both of us will not have tech neck.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking about the cultural history behind posture and where that idea of good posture comes from and that fear of bad posture with Beth Linker. She's the author of Slouch, Posture Panic in Modern America. Beth Linker is a professor of history and social sciences at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks so much for joining us today, Professor Linker. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, Grace. It's been a lot of fun.
Right. I'm Grace Wan in for Mina Kim. Everyone, read the book and stand up straight.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising Simons Foundation.
Do you love your local bookstore? Well, I have the perfect event for you. This Saturday, April 27th, is Independent Bookstore Day. It's a day to celebrate your favorite local bookstore. I'm Olivia Allen Price, host of the Bay Curious podcast here at KQED, and I'm popping in to let you know that we will be hosting an event at Green Apple Books in San Francisco for the occasion. Come out for an author Q&A about the Bay Curious book. We'll be playing some Bay Area-themed trivia. There will be prizes and so much more. And the best part, tickets are donation-based, and all proceeds go to the Prisoners Literature Project. Learn more at kqed.org/live. I hope to see you there.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.